Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, April 25th, 2025, and our friend Ambassador Charles Freeman is back with us. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Glad to be with you, Nima.
Let's start with what's going on between the United States and China. Donald Trump says that they're talking with China in terms of those sort of tariff conflict, war, whatever that would be. Here is what he said, Ambassador.
China. Can you clarify with whom the U.S. is speaking with China? They're saying it's fake news that trade talks are happening.
Well, they had a meeting this morning, so I can't tell you. It doesn't matter who they is. We may reveal it later, but they had meetings this morning, and we've been meeting with China. And so I think you have, Jeff, as usual, I think you have your reporting wrong. Thank you very much. We'll see you. We'll see you.
Here is what he said yesterday. And today we learned that the spokesman of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China said that there is nothing happening between between China and the United States. What do they need to hide it if they're talking with the United States?
Well, I think this is confusion of various sorts. The Chinese, of course, maintain contact with the United States. They always maintain contact. Even when they're at war, they don't withdraw their embassies from the capitals of the countries with which they're at war. They didn't do that in 1962 with India. They didn't do it in 1979 with Vietnam. So, of course, they're in contact. But being in contact does not mean negotiating. And I think there's a great deal of misinformation, disinformation, perhaps, around this issue. For example, the Chinese have just exempted a few American products from their own counter tariffs, the tariffs they imposed in response to Trump's economic warfare on them. This is taken as a, you know, some sort of sign of talks or negotiations or something. It's not. It's just the Chinese looking at what they import. And it, when there is no alternative to a U.S. source, why not import it? You know, they are systematically diverting their trade away from the U.S. wherever possible. But if there's something, a particular semiconductor, for example, that they can only obtain from the United States, why would they deny themselves that? So this is just rational economic policy. And it doesn't mean anything in terms of negotiations. In fact, I think the Chinese have decided to wait this out. They see the United States engaging in self-sabotage, weakening itself. You can see the reactions in the stock markets, the price of gold, the opposition of an increasing number of CEOs at major companies to the Trump tariff tantrum. You can see this in terms of general popular disquiet. And we're about to see empty shelves in Walmart and other commercial outlets that depend heavily on consumer goods from China. I think the Chinese have taken Mr. Trump's measure. They consider him a bully, but they believe that when bullies encounter serious opposition, they retreat. And they see Mr. Trump retreating. And they believe time is on their side, because the pressure on the United States is mounting very, very much. The Chinese can take pressure much better than Americans can. They don't have elections, democratic elections to worry about. They don't have protests to worry about, because they can control that. And they can take various measures to offset the damage to their economy that Mr. Trump's sanctions and tariffs are creating. This means several things. And I think in your own country, in Brazil, in July, you will host the BRICS summit. I expect that the members of the BRICS and those associated with the BRICS who are not yet members will be very actively discussing how to replicate the open trading system that the World Trade Organization formerly assisted until the United States sabotaged it. So they want the BRICS countries will continue with globalization, but they will do it on a plurilateral rather than universal basis. Globalization will continue without the United States. In the meantime, there will be subsidies in China for consumption to offset the damage to private sector businesses that are losing customers in the United States. So I think this is a case of the United States basically shooting itself in its own foot. Mr. Trump seems to believe a number of impossible economic theories. And I would note that his staff, his cabinet, are deeply divided. They have very incompatible economic theories. Peter Navarro, his chief trade officer, advisor, does not believe in Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage, believes that trade is a zero-sum game. I don't know how he can believe that. If China sends three times as many commodities, consumer goods, components to the United States as the United States supplies to China, the U.S. trades little green paper portraits of dead presidents for commodities, why isn't that a good deal for the United States? Mr. Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, seems to believe that Americans want to go back to screwing little screws into objects on an assembly line. I don't think anybody in the United States wants to do that. Mr. Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who appears to have a deep hatred of China, is a hedge fund operator. He claims the Chinese are playing with no cards, but he grossly misjudges the issue in the judgment of many, many economists. And of course, Mr. Trump is willing to accept all of these disparate theories because all he cares about is feeding his ego, showing the world who's boss, gaining power, and as he put it, anticipating the world will come and, as he said, kiss his ass. So he doesn't care what the theories are as long as they serve the purposes of gratifying his ego.
Ambassador, do you think that in the Trump administration, is there anybody who's dealing with the economy of the United States? Is there anybody there willing to hear the people? Many, many economists are talking against the policies of the Trump administration. We have Richard Wolff, Michael Hodson on this podcast, Jeffrey Sachs, I talk with him the same way. Is there anybody hearing these people, the idea of these people?
Well, Mr. Trump's cabinet is apparently composed of people who will flatter him and who will not convey bad news to him. We've seen televised cabinet meetings that are almost a parody of a dictator meeting with his subordinates. I remember when I was ambassador to Saudi Arabia, watching Saddam Hussein conduct his cabinet meetings, during one of which he shot one of his cabinet members and killed him. So everybody at those cabinet meetings was saying, "Oh, Saddam, you are so great, you are so wise, you are so brilliant, everything you are doing is so correct." But of course it wasn't. Mr. Trump has produced the same sort of sycophantic atmosphere in his cabinet room. I don't think anybody's telling him the hard facts. He has taken something that the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said and turned it on its head. Moynihan said, everybody is entitled to their own opinion, but no one is entitled to his own facts. Mr. Trump seems to believe everyone's entitled to his own facts, and no one is allowed to have an opinion that differs with his. So this is not a good mechanism for democratic interchange or even effective governance.
Ambassador, something's happening right now between India and Pakistan. And many people are somehow surprised about it. And in your opinion, what's going on and who's just making this sort of mess? Is something happened just by surprise or something's beyond that?
The Kashmir issue, which is the question of whether Kashmir should belong to India or to Pakistan, be divided or be independent, has been on the United Nations docket since 1947. It is on the business agenda of the General Assembly every year. The Kashmir problem has not been improved. India has clamped down on the major part of Kashmir, the tourist area of the Vale of Kashmir, which it controls, and it's killed a lot of Muslims there. There is a kind of Hindu reign of terror in Kashmir. And it's not helped by Pakistan financing, training, equipping guerrillas, terrorists who come across the border to contest Indian control. So what happened was a mass killing, and probably directed at dramatizing the Kashmir situation and perhaps hurting Kashmir's major industry, which is tourism, because people feel unsafe. It's a destination mainly for Indian tourists, but also for international tourists. And India has attributed this to Pakistan. Whether this is actually done by the Pakistanis or something done by native Kashmiris who feel oppressed, I can't say. But clearly the Indians have taken a very strong retaliatory response to Pakistan, suspending the Indus River Agreement, which shares water between the two of them from the great river, the Indus, and canceling all kinds of other crossing points and exchanges. So I can understand why the Indians are terribly upset. They have a right to be, but on the other hand, they need to recognize that their own actions in Kashmir have produced a resistance, which can be exploited by Pakistan, but which also can operate on its own.
It seems, who's in a position to bring the tensions down in terms of the conflict? I've learned that the foreign minister of Iran was talking about it because they're having a good relationship between Iran and Pakistan and between Iran and India. But who else is capable of doing this?
At the moment, I don't think anyone is. Because if you look at other major powers, the relationships are all quite complicated. There is a historical precedent of the Russians composing differences between India and Pakistan. Lal Bahadur Shastri, the Prime Minister of India, actually was in Tashkent during the Soviet period, and the Soviet Union successfully moderated a truce between India and Pakistan. So there is a record of intervention by third parties to serve as mediators. I don't think anyone is in a better position now than Iran, frankly.
And we have Steve Witkoff today visiting Moscow and talking with Vladimir Putin. We know that tomorrow there is some sort of talk between Iran about the Iranian nuclear program. But the case of the conflict in Ukraine seems to be, as time goes by, is getting much more complicated. Donald Trump on one side says that everything's going well and we are going to get a deal. And here is what Lavrov said in the way they're seeing the conflict in Ukraine.
What President Trump said on Wednesday, the President of the United States says he thinks the U.S. and Russia have a deal. Let's get it done. Does President Putin agree?
Well, the President of the United States believes, and I think rightly so, that we are moving in the right direction. The statement by the president mentions a deal, and we are ready to reach a deal, but there are still some specific points, elements of this deal, which need to be fine-tuned, and we are busy with this exact process. And the president of the United States did not spell out the elements of the deal, so it is not appropriate for me to do this.
But he did say there was a deal and that he was sending his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to meet with Vladimir Putin Friday in Russia. Is that meeting still happening? And should we expect a deal this week?
Yeah. Well, you don't trust the word of the President of the United States?
I was asking your president's word. What will he tell the U.S.?
So somehow he's a classic.
Very classic. So here's the problem. I think Mr. Trump came into office genuinely wishing to end the war in Ukraine, establish a working relationship with Russia that would be to mutual advantage. And that would enable the United States to focus on relations with China, which are hostile. Those were his impulses. So he advocated a ceasefire. So you come in, the problem is the war, so we'll just end the war with it. We'll have a ceasefire. But the ceasefire doesn't solve anything. It just stops the fighting. But there was a purpose for the Russians and for the Ukrainians in this war, and neither of them is prepared to give up the purpose. And in the case of Ukrainians, the issue has been the recovery of lost territories, whether they are Crimea, which peacefully transferred to Russia. That is to say, there was no fighting, particularly the Ukrainian troops who were there were put on buses and sent home in 2014. The Russians who were there stayed. And the populace voted in a referendum to join Russia, which was not the first referendum where they had voted to separate from Ukraine. So that is that issue. And apparently the Trump administration accepts that Crimea is now part of Russia. Then there's the issue of the four oblasts in eastern Ukraine, which are predominantly Russian-speaking. That has been one of the issues to be solved. The Russians have effectively taken that off the table because they've seized those oblasts, almost all of their territory, not all of it. One of the oblasts, all of the territory, in the case of the other three, partial territory, is in the hands of the Russians, and they're not going to give it up because they think that on the basis of the record, this is the only way to protect Russian speakers in these formerly Ukrainian oblasts. But there are other issues here. From the Russian point of view, the purpose of the war was to ensure there were no hostile forces from NATO, Western Europe, stationed in Ukraine, aimed at Russia. That's a perfectly understandable objective. And the Russians will insist on Ukrainian neutrality. And European talk about so-called resiliency force in Ukraine, it's just not going to get anywhere. And the third issue, and by far the most important for the Russians and for the Europeans in the end, is some sort of security agreement that reduces the fear of Russia that it will be attacked from the West and reduces the fear of the West that Russia will attack it. So this has to be a balanced exchange. Now, what's happened in the U.S.-Russian dialogue is that it has not been able to get much beyond the issue of ceasefire. Now, that seems to be what Mr. Trump is mostly interested in. Mr. Putin has had in mind and continues to have in mind the broader objectives of Ukrainian neutrality and the negotiation of a new arrangement for Europe that would reassure Russia and the West against threats. So he's not going to waver in that. So when Mr. Lavrov says we're moving in the right direction in these talks, evidently that is true. I think the Russians have characterized Mr. Witkoff's discussions with Vladimir Putin as positive and constructive. Some progress has been made, it is claimed, but we are nowhere near a comprehensive agreement. And as I think Mr. Lavrov said, this has turned out to be more complicated than people imagined. Final note, I think things are heading towards some sort of rupture between the United States and its European allies. And in the end, it is Europeans who are going to have to work out the security architecture with the Russians that will reassure them and the Russians. not the United States. The United States, oddly enough, seems prepared to work out a deal with the Russians, while the Europeans at present are not. They have no proposal for peace. All they are proposing is more of the same, military confrontation with Russia. They're talking about transferring more weapons and putting more forces into Ukraine. This is not going to solve anything. So we're not at the point of a deal. My last comment is, Mr. Trump is not known for his patience, and he has been very impetuous in this setting. He has he seemed to endorse Marco Rubio's statement that if this wasn't solved in a few days, we would walk away, the United States would walk away. Of course, we are in a very strange position because this was an American proxy war, but now we're pretending we're some kind of mediator, neutral mediator between Europeans and Russians. This doesn't make sense. Anyway, Mr. Trump has now thrown Mr. Rubio out of the picture by saying, no, I have patience. It's going to take time. We're not walking away. So poor Mr. Rubio is once again embarrassed, I imagine.
Why do they not try to talk with Europeans? And I'm talking about Witkoff and his team. And we know that Witkoff is in Russia, is in the Middle East, talking with Iran and Russia. Why do they not try to talk with Europeans? Why? Who's going to negotiate? Who's going to talk? Who's going to convince Europeans?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And the answer probably is the same as the one I gave when I was describing the impasse and lack of progress in trade talks with the Chinese. And that is, the Trump administration is full of internal disagreements. You know, Mr. Vance is an America firster, and he seems to be in line with Mr. Trump's thinking. And he would like to have the war in Ukraine ended. But Mr. Waltz, the National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio, and others are all well-known neoconservatives who want the war to be escalated. And oddly enough, when the talks in London that were scheduled to take place between the Ukrainians and the Europeans, with the Americans present, had the Ukrainians walk out on those talks, the representative of the United States, General Kellogg, clearly fits in the neoconservative camp. He's a military man. He thinks of military solutions. He's come up with some fairly bizarre proposals that the Russians are not interested in, nor the Ukrainians for that matter. For example, taking the nuclear power plants at Zaporizhia and turning them over to the United States. There's a lot of contradictions here. We just had Treasury Secretary Bessent go to Argentina, your neighbor to the south, and castigate the Chinese for proposing rapacious mining deals. Well, what do you think the proposed minerals deal with Ukraine is? If it is not rapacious, I don't know what that word means. So there are a lot of contradictions. There's no coherence. Everything in the end is decided by Mr. Trump, and he doesn't seem to be bothered by contradictions as long as his ego is gratified.
As you mentioned, Ambassador, the situation is so much complicated, but it doesn't seem that Europe is helping itself as the same way that the Trump administration is doing. We know that this concept of sending peacekeepers to Ukraine, and after weeks of talking about this, right now they're like, we're not going to send our troops to Ukraine, but we want some sort of security guarantee for Ukraine, something like Article 5 of NATO. Why should the United States give this to Ukraine if the whole war is about NATO, is about the situation in Ukraine, which we know that it's in the NATO part is so much important for Russia?
Well, here's the question. Do you believe European security depends on dividing Europe into blocks, one headed by Russia, with maybe Belarus and possibly one other country confronting the rest of Europe? Or do you think peace and stability in Europe require the end of that division and the end of military confrontation? And if you ask yourself, what security guarantee does Ukraine need? The answer is it needs a guarantee from Russia. And that guarantee has to be in response for a guarantee from NATO, from Western Europe, to Russia, that the West will no longer promote the recruitment of Ukraine as a hostile power on Russia's doorstep, and will no longer say what Europeans have been saying quite publicly, namely that the reason they need to help Ukraine is in order to punish and deter Russia and weaken and isolate Russia. And that is the reason to support you. There's nothing in there about helping Ukrainians develop a democratic, non-corrupt system and fitting into the European Union, which the Russians have never objected to. What's the future of Ukraine? The European position seems to be fight to the last, fight to the death. The American position is confused, but at least it proposes some kind of end to the fighting.
And Europe is asking for, Reuters reported that Europeans are asking for they want to use the Russian frozen assets for reconstruction of Ukraine in the aftermath of a Ukrainian settlement. If that's the idea, which I think, after all, they have to reconstruct, they have to help Ukraine to rebuild itself. But why they're thinking this way, just seizing the Russian assets and using them for Ukraine instead of giving them to Russia and making some sort of agreement to Russia be part of the reconstruction of Ukraine, which I would believe that they're happy with that concept.
Well, I think the Russians would be prepared to be part of the effort. In fact, when the coup happened in 2014, the Russians seemed to be quite prepared to have Ukraine operate between Russia and the European Union and benefit from trade with both. That is, the heavy industry in Ukraine was mainly in the east, in Donbass, the very oblasts, so the mining is there too, which are now in Russian hands. They were prepared to leave those as part of Ukraine. They were prepared to continue an economic cooperative relationship with Ukraine. Apparently, NATO, Europe, the United States were not prepared to tolerate that. We're back at we have not resolved this issue. 3 years of fighting have not resolved it. 3 more years of fighting are not going to resolve it. And what is needed is a political solution. The Europeans proposing military measures in the absence of a political context accomplishes nothing. And that's why I would say, you know, the Europeans obviously should be at the table. These are issues that deeply affect their security and well-being. But if the Europeans have nothing to say except more warfare should occur, well, what's the benefit of having them at a negotiating table? So they've got to come through. Let me make a point here too, and that is, Europeans are talking, in Germany, they're talking about transferring Taurus missiles to the Ukrainians. These are a very formidable missile system that flies at very low altitude, very hard to stop, and it goes a very long distance. The Russians have said that if this transfer takes place, they will retaliate against Germany. So how will they do that? With nuclear weapons? We don't know.
Lavrov.
Pardon me? Shoigu.
Shoigu
just made that threat. This is all a waste of time. And in the meantime, people are dying. Mr. Trump is absolutely correct to focus on that. Both sides should want to end this on a basis that leaves them with as much as they can hope for. And in the case of Ukraine, they're not going to recover those oblasts. They basically, by persecuting the Russian speakers, by attacking them in the civil war between 2014 and 2022, they discredited themselves by repudiating the Minsk Accords. They lost all credibility with the Russians. That issue is not up for, it really cannot be resolved in any way other than letting the Russians keep what they have. It's been suggested that the Russians, despite their constitution, which includes all of the territory of Crimea and the four oblasts in question, despite that, the Russians might be prepared to let the Ukrainians keep those portions of the three oblasts that they hope they continue to occupy, just keep them. But that's something to be negotiated, and it would be very difficult. The major issue is not territory. It never has been. The Minsk Accords had no element of territorial claim from Russia, but a lot of things have happened since then. The real issue is, what is the place of Ukraine in European security architecture? Is it something like Austria under the 1955 Austrian State Treaty, neutral with respect for minorities in a largely German-speaking country? Or is it warfare? It cannot be. I mean, the Trump administration is realistic. They are being accused, the Trump administration, is being accused of giving away all sorts of things to the Russians. But this is basically just the Europeans repeating their unwillingness to tolerate, to recognize what the battlefield has resulted in. The battlefield has resulted in Russia gaining these territories. And you cannot proceed on to negotiate something that ignores that reality. If you do, you just perpetuate the fighting. I think this is a bit of a mess, but I take it that it is moving in the right direction. Mr. Trump has done the right thing by withdrawing his impatience and saying he's willing to continue. And let's hope Mr. Witkoff, who's very inexperienced in these matters, apparently quite a good negotiator, someone who listens, someone who learns. Let's hope he can produce further progress. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. The news lady who was interviewing Mr. Lavrov clearly doesn't understand the situation.
Did you watch the pictures from Moscow, Witkoff getting there and talking with Putin, just handshaking? It was just Witkoff. Nobody else was with him. And it seems that the lady on the right side of him, she was the translator of Witkoff. But is that common to have just a single person going there to talk? We know that he's going to talk about Ukraine. He's going to talk about Iran. Is that normal?
It's not normal. The issue is not how many people there are representing the United States. The issue is that Mr. Witkoff is not an officer of the United States. He has not been approved by the Senate. He is a crony business partner of the president. He is representing the president in a personal capacity. He's not doing so constitutionally. He has no legal standing. Of course, if he can produce a deal, then it will have to be ratified by the political process in the United States. It should be a treaty ratified by the Senate. But he's operating entirely outside the legal framework. And I don't see anybody with him. I don't know what sort of backup he has. As I said, I think he's an intelligent, able man. But his experience is in real estate. Maybe he's just the person to work out Mr. Trump's vision for Gaza, Riviera in the Eastern Mediterranean. That would be something he's perfectly suited for. he's not yet been able to prove he's able to deal with the complex political issues that are involved in Palestine or with Iran or in Ukraine, and he's not been dealing with the Europeans.
Meloni recently had a meeting with Donald Trump talking about tariffs. Do you think that her position in Europe would help the attitude of the United States in Ukraine?
I'm sorry, who had a meeting with him?
Meloni, the president.
Meloni, Giorgia Meloni.
Giorgia Meloni, yeah.
Prime Minister, yes. Well, I think Italy is its own voice within European councils. It's not part of the chorus. Apparently, Ms. Meloni and Mr. Trump have a good relationship, are able to talk to each other pretty directly. At the right time, I think she could be very helpful, but we're not at the right time yet. That is, Europeans have to get their act together. When they do, she may be a very effective representative of Europe in this context.
Yeah. Are you somehow surprised with Hungary and Slovakia? During the Biden administration, we were hearing them that Donald Trump would do this, would do that. And right now, they're so calm. Do you think that they're believing that Donald Trump is doing something there, something important, and is trying to solve it? They don't need to participate. They don't need to put pressure on Germany, France, United Kingdom, or they're just doing this without talking about it.
Well, they're ideologically aligned with Mr. Trump in some ways, particularly in their opposition to the so-called woke values that other Europeans have adopted and which are now being persecuted in the United States. So they're on the ideological alignment with Mr. Trump. They're also, both of them, realists, and they understand their neighbors of the Russians. So they had a long experience with the Russians. I don't know about Mr. Fico, but Mr. Orban is fluent in Russian, having been educated in the Soviet period. I think they understand Russia pretty well. They understand what the issues are. And I think they hope for peace, and they hope for an arrangement that will integrate them back into Europe. They've both been pretty much isolated by other Europeans. So I think they want acceptance within Europe, and that requires the kind of deal that Mr. Witkoff may be discussing with the Russians.
We know that Witkoff is going to talk about Iran with Vladimir Putin. And it seems sort of, last week it was the same. He went to Moscow and then talked with Iranian on Saturday. Here is what Donald Trump said about the negotiations with Iran.
Going to Rome, where we'll be attending the funeral of Pope Francis. Some of you are going to go, anybody going? And it's going to be very interesting. We're going to meet with a lot of the foreign leaders. They want to meet. Trade deals are going very well. I think Russia and Ukraine, I think they're coming along, we hope. It's very fragile. And Iran, I think, is going very well. We'll see what happens. We're working on plenty of things.
Iran is going very well.
No, this is the typical bravado that Mr. Trump exudes. I wouldn't take it too seriously as a judgment about what is happening. But he hopes it will go well, of course. As I think I have mentioned before, optimism is, in diplomacy, optimism is the equivalent of courage in warfare. You have to be optimistic. You have to imagine that you can persuade the other side to accept your view of what should be done, or you don't persist and you don't achieve that result. So I think this is, this happy talk that he puts on from time to time is part of a bargaining process. It's keeping the door open to an agreement. And it's not an accurate description of what is actually happening, and it isn't really intended as such. So we hear that there are all the statement from Catherine, his press secretary, was that there are 18 countries that have put forward offers in writing for trade agreements. We don't know what those are, and as I indicated in discussing with this issue with China, nobody knows what the U.S. really wants or demands. There's no U.S. negotiating position. So this is kind of like you're standing at the door and waiting for your cat to bring a bird to your feet, you know. Maybe it will happen, maybe it won't. But when the Japanese asked the Trump administration what it wanted and needed, they got no coherent answer, because the Trump administration is internally divided. Different people have different purposes, and there's no coherence to this. The only unifying factor is make Mr. Trump look good. They all want to do that because their jobs depend on it.
Donald Trump had an interview with Time magazine in which he was talking about Iran. He said that he was asked if he stopped Israel to attack Iran. And he said, no, I didn't do that, but didn't make it comfortable for them. And then when he was asked if he's going to participate in any sort of war with Iran if Israel decides to go do that, he said, and we're not going to be out of it. We're going to be participating and helping Israel. Ambassador, when they're negotiating with Iran, they're talking with Iran, what is the necessity of not just saying, I did stop Israeli attack, and while I'm negotiating, nobody's able, I give no permission to Israel to attack Iran. That would be hugely beneficial to talks that are happening right now between the United States and Iran.
Well, I agree. From the Iranian point of view, that would relieve some of the effort to humiliate Iran. That would be set a positive atmosphere. As it is, Araghchi and Witkoff are left to do that on their own, with no backing from Mr. Trump. But I want to say here that it's not unusual in negotiations for one hand to offer peace and the other hand to be a fist, ready to punch you in the nose. Here we have a 60-day window that Mr. Trump has set that is quite unrealistic, obviously, given the technical complexity of any agreement on nuclear matters. We now have a technical experts participating in the discussions between Iran and the United States. That's a good sign. Meantime, B-2 bombers are assembled at Diego Garcia, as are aerial refueling tankers to presumably enable those bombers to reach Iran with an escort of fighter jets of some sort. Of course, the purpose of that is to avoid overflying any of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, the Arab countries, who've made it quite clear they don't want to be part of a war with Iran, and they don't want to be, and they've taken to heart Iranian warnings that if they cooperate in an attack on Iran, Iran will attack them. They don't want that. They know Iran could do huge damage to their oil facilities, for example. So they're trying to sit this out. I would just say finally that any military assault on Iran from Diego Garcia would be problematic because of the distance, because of the ways Iran has prepared itself with deep underground facilities to resist that, both missiles stored underground and nuclear facilities underground. There's nothing, I mean, I would expect if an attack set off from Diego Garcia, that an Iranian missile or two might hit Diego Garcia. The Iranian missile inventory is apparently quite effective. So Iran has quite an arsenal that it can expend. And I think it would also hit Israel. As for Mr. Trump saying, well, if, you know, if there's a war, we will be with Israel. I take that as an expedient bow to domestic politics in the United States, not a firm statement. And I would note, finally, in this regard, that during Prime Minister Netanyahu's meeting in the Oval Office with the press present, Mr. Trump actually embarrassed Netanyahu on two issues. Netanyahu started to criticize President Erdogan in Turkey, and Mr. Trump said, well, he's one of my favorite guys. And, you know, I guess because maybe the two of them are equally indifferent to the constitution of the country there they govern. And when Mr. Netanyahu began to talk about Iran, Mr. Trump said, we're going to negotiate with Iran, which was the opposite of what Mr. Netanyahu wanted. He wanted, we're going to go to war with Iran. That's what he's been aiming at forever. And in Israel, the Israeli press and Israeli public opinion recognized that Mr. Netanyahu came back empty-handed from his visit to Washington. He was essentially summoned to Washington by Mr. Trump, and he got nothing. I think when Mr. Trump says we'll be with Israel, you know, that's a political statement. I wouldn't read too much into it.
Yeah. And the Hamas has announced that they're ready to talk, to negotiate again with the United States and with Israel. And on the other hand, Mahmoud Abbas has a different solution for the conflict. He says that if they just simply release all the hostages and prisoners, and they can put an end to the conflict, to the war in Gaza. But is that the case for Lebanon? Is that the case for Syria?
No, I don't think Mahmoud Abbas has any credibility at all among Palestinians. He's long since lost his constitutional status. He lost the last elections, which were in 2006. You know, that's a long time ago, and 19 years. And he has remained as president of the Palestinian Authority, Ra'is, as in Arabic, chief or president. He has no sway in Gaza. He has very little credibility on the West Bank. He is basically on the payroll of the United States and Israel. His police forces are part of the Israeli oppression of Palestinians in the West Bank. I don't think anybody really considers him part of the solution. Who's he speaking on behalf of? Israel? No, I don't think so. I don't think he has a mandate from Israel to describe how the war will end. And as for Hamas saying it's willing to negotiate, it's always been willing to negotiate. Israel is the one that doesn't want to negotiate. Israel wants to annex Gaza and resettle it with Jewish settlers. And it wants the Palestinians gone one way or another, either shot or starved to death or somehow expelled from alive from Gaza. And in the meantime, of course, there are more and more horrible stories coming out of the West Bank. What is Mr. Abbas doing about that? Nothing. So I'm sorry to say this. I'm sure he's a very fine gentleman, but he has no credibility.
Yeah. Before wrapping up this session, Ambassador, if we assume that he's so much optimistic about the talks between Iran and the United States, they can achieve something, an agreement, a new agreement. If that could be achieved, how is it going to influence the situation of Gaza? Is that gonna put Netanyahu in a better position, in a weaker position? I'm talking about Israel and consequently the situation of Gaza.
Well, I think it would have a tremendous impact on Israeli internal politics. Mr. Netanyahu is fighting for his political life, even as he continues to promote a war of annihilation of Palestinians. He's having to appear in court to discuss various criminal charges of fraud and corruption with the court in secret. Many of his subordinates have been charged with improper relationships involving the Arab state of Qatar. And so one of his main motivations in continuing the war appears to be a personal exemption from trial and imprisonment. So if he loses the support of the United States on the Iran issue, which he has made a central platform of his political career, I think he would be badly damaged and very likely come down. But what that would do to Gaza, I don't know. You know, the people who are waiting to succeed Mr. Netanyahu are even farther to the right and crueler, less wedded to respect for the West and Western values than he is, which is saying a good deal. I understand, or there is a rumor, I don't know if it's true or not, that the Iranian side, through Mr. Araghchi, has proposed an interim agreement, some kind of stopgap measure, so that there will be enough time to deal with the technical issues. Mr. Witkoff has reportedly rejected that. The 60-day deadline is tied to the threat of war. So this is still a very dangerous situation. And despite all of the arguments, sensible arguments against a war, including the possibility that the United States would be badly damaged in a war, and that it would have a transformative effect on American influence in Western Asia, the danger of a war hasn't gone away. The clock is ticking. Mr. Trump is temperamental. We don't know what he will do. I don't think he wants a war at all, but he sees the threat of war as a major point of leverage on Iran. It also keeps Mr. Netanyahu quiet. So that's got that benefit too.
But if they go to war with Iran, that would be the end of the Trump administration.
It would be a transformative event. Well, so many things could be the end of the Trump administration. But I think they're mainly domestic in the sense that the opposition to him is strengthening daily. Because of issues like the behavior of our immigration and customs enforcement people, who've now had to back away from their peremptory deportation of students. Court has banned that, and they are crossing red lines in popular opinion, and this generates opposition to the Trump administration, which is already considerable. If you look at the volatility in the stock market, you look at the bond market, you look at the price of gold, you look at the apprehensions of consumers, the inability of companies to invest because of the uncertainties facing them, and the slowdown and the prospect that we're all going into a recession, both in the United States maybe and abroad. This is self-generated by Mr. Trump and his administration, and it threatens that administration. So I'm not sure that an Iran war necessarily would bring the administration down, but it would certainly add greatly to the opposition to it.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Good to be with you, Neiman.